Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust.
Hello and welcome to the program. This podcast will feature the second part of Peter Gutman's keynote speech from the KiwiCon Computer Security Conference in Wellington. He's talking about the psychology of the users of computer software versus the people who design the software and their psychology. This second part of the keynote is a must listen for anyone who designs software interfaces or works in an industry where authentication is important, like banking. It can also be quite funny. Gutman will tell us why you need to delude yourself continuously to be considered mentally healthy. To listen to part one of this presentation, go to itradio.com.au/security and find the post for Risky Business number 43. As I explained then, Gutman is an academic at the University of Auckland and a real crypto buff. He even co-wrote PGP 2.0 in the early 90s. And here he is discussing the difference between geeks and normal humans in the second half of his lecture.
Geeks actually tend to think quite a bit differently from normal humans. An example being brand recognition. So let's say a bunch of people go into a store and want to buy a DVD player. Typical human goes in there, they see two brands, Kamakuza and Philips. So they recognise the Philips brand, I'll buy that. Geeks look at the two and they see that the Kamakuza player supports every video format you can imagine. It's got external USB inputs, it's got an SD card reader, it's got all sorts of stuff that the other player doesn't. And so they buy the Kamakuza player rather than the Philips. So basically, the normal human is using simple heuristics, the recognition prime decision-making model. I recognise that brand, I'll buy it. And the geek is applying the full economic model where they trade off all the different benefits and advantages and disadvantages and so on and so forth and buy a particular player based on the cool features and buzzwords and whatnot that it supports. And for both sides, it's a completely natural, sensible way to make a decision. If you go to a normal human and say, you should have bought this unknown brand Kamakuza player, they'll look at you like, you know, they expect this cuckoo to leap out of your forehead or something. And conversely, you know, the other way around, it's perfectly logical for both sides, but they can't convince the other side that that's a good way of doing things. So they've come to completely opposite conclusions using thinking methods that make perfect sense to them. So here's an example of sort of the difference between geeks and humans. There's MBTI, which is a psychometric used for personality to get personality traits. Just sort of a footnote on this. It classifies personalities by Jungian personality types. It's not necessarily a personality test. It's often misrepresented as a personality test. It's just a way of sorting humans into different bins. And there's a particular type, personality type, that geeks used to have. Geeks tend to have TJ, and in particular security people have a preponderance of J's, which I won't go into the details, it's just a particular bin that MBTI can sort you into.
I've actually seen it. The MBT guy, our group did, and typically I think people are they're represented similarly in a square, basically, on a circle that plots strength in four different traits.
Yep.
All the people in our group basically had a sphere of destiny thing going, not to
I've seen that as well for a computer science class. Yeah, it was basically the single spike, and that was it. Geeks are very, very different from the rest of the population. If you look at the population as a whole, only 7% of the population has that particular profile. So basically 93% of users that geeks build their security software for think entirely differently from the way that geeks do, at least according to this way of sorting personalities. So here's a final example of the difference between geeks and normal humans. I should emphasise, this is a simple, logical problem. This is not a trick question. It's a basic piece of straightforward logic. All of Anne's children are blonde. Is it valid to say that some subset of Anne's children are blonde? Actually, can I get a show of hands? How many people think that that's valid? Pretty much everybody. Okay. How many people think that's not valid? One or two. Okay. And how many people think that that's a trick question and haven't dared raise their hands? No, honestly, it's not a trick question. Obviously, basically, in Aristotelian logic, it's a subalternation, and it's valid. It's basically a simple logical problem. The thing is, 70% of all humans consider that to be invalid. The reasons for that is pretty complicated to explain. I've got a text write-up on this, and that goes into it a bit more detail. It's not terribly interesting, but basically, you know, the majority of this room thinks it's valid. The majority of non-geeks thinks it's invalid. And this result as psychologists point out, this result is robust. So if you try this across lots of different cultures, not just European and American, but cultures all around the world, and you phrase it in all sorts of different ways, and the results are always consistently the same, that the majority of non-geek humans think that that particular logical statement is invalid. But what it points out is, you know, the people creating the security software think very, very differently from the majority of people that are actually using the software. So there's this thing called user conditioning. And again, this is an example of the possibly counterintuitive ways that human minds work. Once people adopt a particular belief, they're very, very reluctant to change it. This was even Gestalt psychologists, sort of 100-odd years ago, recognised this. They gave it a name called Einstein. So here's an example that psychologists did in an experiment. They gave people a bunch of suicide notes, and as they asked people to analyse them as in a problem-solving exercise. And these people were actually psychology students, so they knew at least something about this. And the users were evaluated based on their performance in distinguishing fake from genuine suicide notes. And they were given feedback saying, you've done well, you've done badly, based on how well you've evaluated these notes. At the end of the experiment, they were told that all this was a bunch of crap. This was completely fictitious. You've been given totally random feedback. So even though the users knew that they'd been given completely random feedback, they still rated themselves based on this completely fictitious random feedback that they'd been given. And that's an example of this, you know, this so-called Einstellung, that once you've adopted a particular belief, you're very, very reluctant to change it, even if it's been proven that your belief is wrong. So what happens is, once you get a particular type of feedback, you start looking for further evidence to support it. It's something called the Barnum effect, or the Forer effect, or the subjective validation effect. Again, depending on which psychologists looked at this, they've all given it different names. So here's another example of this. Some of these are kind of neat. So there's a professional palm reader, and his customers gave him a very, very high accuracy rating. They said, we're very, you know, satisfied with the accuracy of these guys' predictions. So some researchers went to him and said, for the next week, could you tell people exactly the opposite of what your readings are actually telling you? And customers were just as satisfied with the readings, even though they were exactly the opposite of what he'd been telling them beforehand. Another example, subjects were given a political statement to read, and half of them were told it was by Thomas Jefferson, half were told it was by Lenin. Those who thought it was by Jefferson said it advocated political debate, and those who thought it was by Lenin said it advocated violent revolution. Exactly the same statement. Again, because they decided that, you know, this is what the thing must be doing. And there's lots and lots of results like this. This is actually, you know, if you read sort of reports from experimental psychologists, they really, really like doing this to people. And here's a real-world example. Try reading a description of some new medicine or some new therapy or seeing a piece of exercise equipment or whatever on TV and see how many of the symptoms of whatever this thing is supposed to treat actually directly correspond to symptoms you're experiencing at the moment. So, you know, that happens in the real world as well. So the reason why our minds do these apparently weird things is they basically evolved for survival and reproduction. They didn't actually evolve for automatically seeking the truth in this sort of hardcore scientific manner. And quick and dirty techniques work reasonably well most of the time. The result of this is that we can more or less rationalise away anything. So, and here's an example again of this rationalising away anything. This is another one of these things that psychologists like doing to people. So they gave a bunch of subjects this canned biography on someone and included some random piece of information like he joined the Navy or he committed suicide or something like that. In every case, people would come up with some reason why these different factors matched up. For example, if there's a fact that said maybe he was lonely as a kid, then that would explain him joining the Navy. Okay, he was lonely, so he wanted to join the Navy where there's lots of other people around him. It also, exactly the same fact, explained him committing suicide. He was lonely, so he committed suicide. And again, they were then told that all this information was false, and they still maintained their beliefs. So people will construct plausible explanations for stuff and continue to believe it, even when it's proven that it's false, which is, again, it's a serious problem. It plays right into the hands of con artists and the computer security case into phishers, because they really, really want to believe this, and they'll delude themselves into believing it. And even when they're told that this is false, they'll still, to some extent, continue to believe it. And again, there's another example of researchers creating they created what they called inexplicable situations. They created, jammed together two completely random sentences. Kenneth made his way to a TV shop, see they had her ears pierced. And then the told subject, you've got 10 seconds to come up with an explanation, some way of explaining why these two sentences belong together. And 71% of them could immediately, within 10 seconds, come up with an explanation. So they could rationalise away utterly random, unconnected sentences without too much trouble. And there's an example of getting back to security again, of humans going to a phishing site. This is part of a phishing study. And for every one of these things, they immediately came up with some reason why this particular bizarre behaviour was valid. Yahoo.com is a subdirectory of Yahoo. You know, other sites only use IP addresses. These sites only using an IP address, and so on and so forth. They could rationalise away every one of these phishing behaviours. And this is normal human behaviour. This wasn't just people, you know, turning off their thinking process while they were sitting in front of this dialogue. As the other sort of the examples I gave earlier have demonstrated, this is normal human behaviour throughout life, not just specific to the computer security situation. So here's an extreme example. There are some patients who have, this isn't done so much anymore because there's better treatments for it now, but it used to be used, that people with very severe epileptic seizures, they'd actually have their two brain hemispheres severed in order to reduce the severity of these epileptic seizures. It's known as a split brain. And there's a huge amount of research that's been done on these patients because they make for kind of interesting subjects. And so what researchers found is that the left half of the brain could rationalise away stuff that the right half of the brain was doing, even though it literally had no idea why the other half of the brain was doing this. There was no physical connection between the two halves anymore. And so, you know, here's another example of this. There was a psychiatric evaluation that used to be used some time ago called the draw person diagnosis method. People were asked to draw a person, and based on how they drew this person, it told you various things about them, until experimental psychologists came along and showed that it was a load of bollocks and the results were more or less meaningless. But anyway, so they gave a bunch of people these draw person tests and randomly associated psychiatric disorders with different drawings. And again, in every case, these psychology students could come up with some reason why this person had this psychiatric disorder based on this, you know, shown to be random example in this diagram. So as I said earlier, experimental psychologists really like messing with people. If you're a psychology student at a university and you get asked to take a particular test as part of your course, then be very, very nervous about what they're doing to you. So again, here's some examples, sort of getting a bit off track here, but some of these are kind of interesting. Human vision. So humans have a blind spot at the back of the retina where the optic nerve attaches to the eyeball. So there's actually no vision in that blind spot. And what happens is the mind fills in the blanks based on data from the surrounding area. So you can't actually see this blind spot in the middle of your vision. There's various tricks you can use, for example, staring at a page, staring at items on a page where you can perceive the blind spot. But normally, the brain just fills in the blanks based on information from the surrounding area. There are a very small number of creatures that actually have properly designed eyeball. Octopi are one example. This is actually kind of neat for annoying intelligent design advocates because it means that the designer made a mistake when he designed humans, and octopi are actually the perfectly designed life form. Another example is something called confabulation across saccades. So when you think your eyes are still, but you're constantly making these tiny little jerky movements called saccades, and what happens is the mind actually smooths out your vision during these movements so you don't notice this, so you kind of get seasick. And you're actually blind during these movements. So if people have set up experiments where they shine a camera onto the eyeball, and as soon as they notice it making one of these jerky movements, they change the scene on a computer monitor in front of you. And because you're blind, and because the mind is sort of editing out this jerky movement and patching over the details, you can't notice changes in the scenery in the monitor right in front of you. And it also leads to something called the frozen hand phenomenon. If you've got an analog watch, sometimes if you look down at it, you'll notice the second hand seems to have frozen, and then suddenly it starts moving. And again, that's the mind editing over this discrepancy. It's looking down there, it sees the hand moving, it thinks, okay, it's a saccade, I'll just edit this out and freeze the hand for a minute into the position where I think it should be. And then it stops the editing and the second hand starts moving. So this self-deception isn't actually a bug. It's a psychological defence mechanism. You'd think that this, you know, living in La La Land is actually a bug. It isn't. There's this thing called depressive realism, in which depressed people have a better grasp of reality than normal people. So if this is, let's say, you think an accurate perception of the world, it used to be thought that, you know, the typical person is around here somewhere, and depressed people are down here somewhere. In reality, depressed people are here, and everyone else is way up here somewhere, busily deluding themselves about the state of the world. So depressives actually suffer from a deficit in self-deception. And that's what I mentioned earlier, that you know, if there are people that act, that see the world rationally and exactly the way it is, that kind of leads to psychiatric disorders. So conventional notions of mental health are that you need to delude yourself in order to have good mental health. Yeah, basically what I just said. So basically, some level of irrationality is a fundamental aspect of human nature. If you remove self-deception, then mental disorders emerge. I'll skip through this one. I've done this, but this is just an offshoot of something I did in the usability talk, so I'll skip through this one. But it's something called the Simon Says problem. So basically, if you're using a browser or anything with security indicators, for example, you know, the tiny padlock at the bottom of the browser, users are expected to change their behaviour in the absence of a stimulus rather than the presence of a stimulus. So here's an example of this, again, from psychology. Subjects were shown sets of trigrams, basically cards with three different cards with letters on them. And they said these cards have a special feature. And after seeing on average 34 sets of these trigrams, people figured out that the special feature was that there was always a T present on one of the three cards. Then they reversed it, and so they made sure there was not a T present on one of the three cards. And no one was ever able to detect this. No matter how many of these trigrams they saw, they could never detect the absence of the stimulus. So that's exactly, this is a psychological experiment showing that humans cannot do this. And that's exactly what user interface designers expect us to be able to do in browsers. You have to detect the absence of a stimulus like a padlock. Okay, and another example of these kinds of problems. So people find negative information very difficult to process. Here's an example. Again, this is psychologist users. It's a propositional calculus problem. Today's not Wednesday, then it's not a public holiday. Today's not a public holiday, is today not Wednesday? People find these particular logical problems far harder to evaluate than anything phrased positively. So, okay, look at this. If today's not Wednesday, it's not a public holiday, then see what a browser does. If the padlock is not showing, then the security is not present. That's exactly what psychologists have told us humans find very, very difficult to deal with. You couldn't actually make this any worse if you deliberately designed it that way. There's something called inattentional blindness, which basically says that people don't register objects unless you're consciously paying attention to them. The best-known example was done by two psychologists, Simons and Chabris, in 1999, called Gorillas in Our Midst. This is very popular on pop psychology programs on TV, so a lot of people may have already seen this one. There's two basketball teams, one with black players, one with white players. Subjects get told to count the number of times they bounce the ball. Halfway through, this person in a gorilla suit prances across the stage and sort of beats their chest and prances off again. Only 54% of users actually noticed this, and it's extremely well, afterwards, if you get told, did you see the gorilla, and you look at it again, it's extremely obvious. But if you're not told in advance, you just don't notice it, and that's an attentional blindness because you're not paying attention to it. It's encountered on the road quite commonly. If you ride a bike or a motorbike, you'll know about this, that you're basically invisible to standard drivers, because drivers are looking for cars and to a lesser extent pedestrians, but anyone on a bike is not a car, and therefore they simply don't register. You can actually do that. You can actually get in the US, you can change your bike's profile from not a car to car by getting these two huge sort of handles that come out the side of your bike and have lights out about here. And suddenly you've got the radar cross-section of a car and other drivers notice you. The downside is your bike looks incredibly ugly from this. But basically the padlock is a perfect match for inattentional blindness. I mean, researchers have found up to a 100% failure rate for these indicators. People aren't looking out for them. They don't even realise they're there. And there's some more examples. So one neat thing, if you've used Vista, that's a standard UAC dialog. Has anyone ever noticed that the border of that dialog changes colour in different circumstances? Not many of us use it. But yeah, so the point is, typically people have never realised that these things have different colours. And in fact, even finding out what these colours are and what the significance is almost impossible. It's buried in an MSDN article, God knows how many pages down. So one of the ways that typically this is addressed, if you're in a job like, let's say, nuclear reactor control or in the military or something like that, you've got standard error mitigation techniques. So you use pre-selection screening, you use academic grades, you use psychological profiles and so on and so forth. So something that you hope gives an indication of the user's performance. You use selection screening, you use entrance exams, you use interviews, you use work training, you use on-the-job evaluation, you use constant drills and testing and so on and so forth. And the more serious it is, the more drilling you do. I guess everybody's seen some example of a nuclear weapons launch drill in some sort of film on TV, the amount of procedure there is involved in training and drilling in that, because it's very serious and you want to make sure that people get it right. So that's with conventional, say industrial equipment control, nuclear reactors, aircraft, that sort of thing. On the other hand, if you've got a computer, someone sitting in front of a computer, there's nothing. There's no training, there's no drilling. You cannot assume anything about your audience. So if you're trying to apply these conventional error mitigation techniques and you assume that users are trained or drilled or whatever, it doesn't work because they have no training whatsoever. And you can't apply any standard mitigation techniques to normal computer users. There's been experimental attempts to do this, to train users. And the results weren't terribly useful. There was one study where they actually trained users to detect phishing email, and they found that it actually had no real effect on their ability to detect phishing email. All it did was scare them into rejecting more email. So it basically raised the false positive rate without producing any other positive benefits. There's something called extended validation certificates, which is someone's described as doing more of what we already know doesn't work, which has been introduced in browsers recently. And users actually performed worse after this education than they had beforehand. Because what the training said is, look at these EV certificates and trust things based on what these certificates say. So I trained them to rely on the wrong security indicators. The site could be as bogus as anything, and as long as it was a vaguely valid-looking certificate, they'd allow it. And obviously, you know, US banks have this proud tradition of training users to rely on inappropriate security indicators. I've got a talk on phishing that goes into this in some detail. There's a neat quote from an antivirus researcher, Vessel and Bontrev, basically saying that if user education was going to work, it would have worked by now. I mean, it's been 15 years, and it still hasn't started working, damn it. So I'll just quickly fly through this. There's something called the bystander effect. Again, this is reasonably well known because of an event in 1964 where a bar manager was murdered outside her apartment. Unfortunately, the media greatly exaggerated this. So she was attacked, and then the attacker ran away, and then later he came back and searched the area for her and stabbed her and raped her, and eventually she died. After half an hour, someone finally called the police. So this was exaggerated by the media. If you read the media reports, it seems like there were people, you know, sitting there looking down on her and not doing anything. It actually wasn't quite that bad. But it led to people to study it. And so the thing with this bystander effect is that it's so noticeable that experimental psychologists can actually quantify it. So the more bystanders there are, the less chance there is of any one individual becoming involved. These figures are from one particular experiment. This doesn't apply in all cases. It just shows that it's quantifiable and that it grows with the number of bystanders. And there's another variation of this. So when people ask, you know, why did you not do anything, or why did you agree with everyone else who was giving the wrong answer? The obvious one is I wanted to fit in. But the other one is that I thought there was something wrong. In this case, it was an eyesight test. I thought there was something wrong with my eyesight because everybody else couldn't all be wrong. It had to be me that was wrong. So this is really nasty on the internet. Remember, it increases with the number of bystanders. Well, on the internet, the entire world is your bystander. This is the worst possible situation into which you can deploy some piece of technology that falls prey to the bystander effect. Here's an example of this. In 1994, there was a security bug discovered in PGP 2.61, known as the XOR bytes bug. This has been present in publicly available source code since PGP 1.0, and nobody had noticed it. And again, there was a similar bug discovered in GPG in 2002, the XOR bytes memorial bug, and that had been in there for 4 years in publicly available source code, supposedly widely scrutinized source code. And it was actually discovered by accident. I contacted the person who found it, and he discovered it more or less by accident. And this is an example of the bystander effect. Everyone assumes that someone else will look at the code. I actually encountered this myself. I wrote an encrypting device, hard drive device driver for MS-DOS a long time ago. And because it was 18,000 lines of assembly language, I didn't want to have to support that. I never released the source code. So I got a number of requests from people who said, you know, can you release the source code so that it can be audited? And I said, yeah, you're welcome to have a copy, just don't release it in public. And they said, well, we don't want to look at it. We expect someone else to look at it for us. And that's exactly the problem with this code, that people want to have source code for security software available, but they expect someone else to look at it. And that's, you know, that's the bystander effect, that nobody actually looks at it because everyone expects someone else to have done the work for them. Another example. Linux dev ran and had a bug in the entropy edition code, which was undiscovered for about 1.5 years. Now, having said that, if you looked at the dev random code, it's kind of messy and hacked over and so on. So the fact that there are bugs in there shouldn't be that surprising. The point is that, you know, many items make bugs shallow only works if there are people actually interested in finding the bugs. And with security code, usually the bystander effect applies. Everyone assumes someone else is looking at it. Some general conclusions. So basically the general conclusion is that humans' minds work very, very differently from geeks' minds. So the people building the software and assuming that the users' minds work in the same way that their minds do, it's not very accurate. Lots of applications, even supposedly user-friendly ones, are basically written by geeks for geeks, not by geeks for people who think very differently from them. The human mind basically works in very, very counterintuitive ways, and there are very good reasons for this behaviour. You can't just say it's stupid or it's irrational. There are reasons why the mind works this way, because if it doesn't work this way, you get psychiatric problems. And finally, you know, geeks are weird. Okay, thanks.
And that's it for this edition of Risky Business, the last one for the year. It's summer here in Australia, and I'm taking a couple of weeks off to eat, drink, surf, and just hang around in the sunshine having a good time. But don't worry, we'll be back in mid-January with more news and analysis from the wonderful world of IT security. Until then, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and all the best for 2008.